Informed and unspun. This is The Big Picture.
Good evening and welcome to The Big Picture. I'm Michael Gaffney, and tonight I'm delighted to be joined by some of the University of Nottingham's most opinionated and hopefully most knowledgeable politicos. Tonight we'll be asking, what's gone wrong for the Lib Dems? Is David Cameron an institutional racist? And how will the privatisation of probation services affect law and order in the UK? And as always, if you want to get involved, please do. You can send a web text into the studio at urn1350.net, or you can tweet us at urn1350 and weigh in to the debate. But without further ado, let's begin with our first one.
There's no easy way to say this. We made a pledge, we didn't stick to it, and for that I'm sorry.
That was Nick Clegg apologising for the tuition fees turnaround. What a time it is to be a Liberal Democrat. I mean, at last they've taken a share in power. They're finally reshaping the country from within government. And of course, that all sounds great, right? Wrong. With the latest Guardian ICM polls showing the Lib Dems in fourth, that's on 11%, behind Labour on 34%, the Tories on 28%, and UKIP on 18%. The prospect of massive losses in 2015, if current trends continue, the future for the Lib Dems looks testing to say the least. And things are going even worse for their leader, the Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, who's gone from hero of the leaders' debates to the zero of the coalition government. And when even Michael Gove is mocking the insecurity of your position, you've got problems. So, beginning with the Liberal Democrats as a whole, I want to ask what has gone wrong and why hasn't sharing in government been the springboard to success that they hoped? But before we begin, I'd like our panel to introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Johnny, a well-versed big picturite.
I'm Elliot, a well-versed Thatcherite.
I'm Joe, not so well-versed in Thatcherism, but hopefully closer to the truth.
I'm James, a big picture virgin and a massive UKIPper.
And I'm Seb, your resident Lib Dem for the evening.
So, Seb, I think we might begin with you, give you the opportunity to defend your party here. What has gone wrong in these years of government for you?
I think a couple of things. Firstly, it started before the election while we were still popular, which was, you know, naivety in some of our manifesto pledges, especially with tuition fees, making such a cast-iron promise, saying that we will vote against any rise in tuition fees, when we knew there was a significant possibility of there being hung parliament and us being in a coalition not being able to deliver that was a mistake. And that clearly hit us hard. I think the second point is that I think all of the policies that we're doing with the Conservatives, obviously compromises that don't really fit with a lot of our base, are inevitably unpopular and policies that we wouldn't have done. And while we've been successful, I think, in getting some of our policies through and making a lot of Conservative policies less bad, it's much harder to kind of project that and say to the electorate, look, yeah, we haven't, you know, traded some of our principles and we haven't done everything we want to do, but, you know, the Conservatives are less worse than they would be without us, so vote for us. And so, you know, that's part of the reason why we've taken such a hit in the polls.
Joe?
Seb's exactly right, actually. There is not much of a leg to stand on at the next election for the Liberal Democrats because, first, they broke promises, which the electorate doesn't like. Second of all, their stance is we've made the Tories less bad, which is not a proper stance at all. I mean, the problem with the Liberal Democrats is there's a big divide between their supporters, cast by the media often as sandal-wearing softy liberals, and then their orange booker leaders, who are far closer to David Cameron and his colleagues than the actual people that vote for them. This is problematic policy-wise. It's also problematic for Nick Clegg, who has become symbolic of what people dislike about the Liberal Democrats. And I don't think his position is as secure as either Ed Miliband or David Cameron's in the next few years or so.
Elliot, you're obviously a supporter of what the Conservative-led government is getting up to. So why has it gone so wrong for the Lib Dems from your point of view?
Well, I think it's partially to do with how wide the Liberal Democrat Party is, because it's made up of some very really left Labour Party members who didn't like the Labour Party, ex-Labour Party members, middle people in the ground, liberals who are, you know, sort of right-wing, and then you've got some libertarians in there. It's such a wide group. I mean, forget the Conservative Party in Broadchurch. This is everybody. And I think that's why it's gone wrong. You know, you can't have a party which is absolutely everybody in the country. Your political parties are formed of people who share like-minded ideas and go together for sort of, I suppose, electoral security, if you want to be really cynical about it. But I think the Liberal Democrats, you know, being so wide has lost them any sort of electoral security, because their voter base is mostly student, which they've really not very happy at the moment. The membership is generally more to the left of the party, and a lot of the people who get anywhere in the party are actually more of the right of it. It's just like Seb said, we've got the Liberal Democrats are just such a weird party compared to every other.
So, to what extent is Nick Clegg the problem? Now, I mean, I alluded to earlier the situation where Michael Gove has been having a crack at him because his leadership is apparently under threat. We've had Vince Cable in The Telegraph giving an interview recently talking about the fact that I might be 70, but I'm still going strong and I would consider the leadership. Has Nick Clegg become a toxic brand? Do they need to get rid? To what extent is Nick Clegg the problem?
He's the problem electorally. He's not necessarily the actual problem himself. I mean, him and his group that took the Liberals into a coalition with the Tories, which, yes, maybe it was necessary, but that is where the problem stems from. But he is seen as incredibly toxic by the voters. Everything has been pinned on him. He himself is incredibly unpopular, and I really don't think they can rebuild their platform and their brand in a new way, which they must do if they're going to have any credibility at the next election, if they don't get rid of him. I mean, the trouble here, I'm sure Seb will back me up on this, is that the Liberal Democrats are basically the only internally democratic party. So it's not that easy to oust your leaders, which in this instance is difficult for you.
Seb, are you going to back your man, or...?
Well, I firstly say it's certainly true that we're kind of the only true internally democratic party, which means I think if we were going to oust a leader, you'd have to oust Clegg and then start a general election rather than, as Gove proposed, you know, implementing Cable in as the leader immediately. I also say Joe's quite on a couple of points, in that symbolically Clegg's the problem. He's seen as everything that's wrong with... Firstly, he was the sign of everything good, as, you know, we ascended just before the election, but also all the compromises and all the mistakes that he made. And also he is, you know, kind of the figurehead of the Orange Bookers, who are perhaps to the right of the rest of the party. However, I don't think it's fair to blame everything on Nick Clegg. Firstly, unsurprisingly, I'd say that I have a more positive view of the Lib Dems' achievements in government than I think anyone else does. So I don't think him or the party have done that badly. But also I think some of the problems are party-wide. But having said that, I think before the next general election, probably will need to get rid of him if we're going to be less hammered and destroyed in the election than we might otherwise be. And if we don't, I could see him being pushed out of leadership almost straight after when we fail worse than we might otherwise.
Elliot, your views?
I think Nick Clegg isn't that very good of a leader, actually, because he's decided to fight on areas where none of his voters care about, essentially. The House of Lords reform, for example, might be a big thing to Liberal Democrat MPs and membership, but their voters don't even care. They don't care about House of Lords reform. They don't care about the sort of economy sort of things. The reason why they went for most people go for the Liberal Democrats, and this has been, you know, since the 1980s with SDP split, it's like the Labour Party light, essentially. They don't like the Labour Party, and so they'll vote for the Liberal Democrats. The economics is one thing which they probably have retained in government, but all the other policies that they should have kept, like one I would have said, if, because of your major voter base, I would have said, defo, we're not going to raise, is the tuition fees one. I mean, it wasn't a massive thing for the Conservatives, but it was a big thing for the Liberal Democrats.
What if, though, Nick Clegg, before the next election, were to walk away? I mean, this is a man who is not just bilingual, he's trilingual. He can speak both German and French fluent. He made his name in the European Parliament. Not only will there be a general election in 2015, the European Commission will also be rotating and bringing a new load in, and I'm sure that that would be a job that would look very nice to Mr. Clegg indeed. Is it not possible that he might look at this situation and say, well, I'm the first ever Liberal Democrat leader to get us into government in any shape or form. I've done all I can.
I'd agree with that. he's in a difficult situation in terms of the Lib Dems. Like Elliot said, their core voters are in a mess. They stand all over the place. And you would probably say that Liberal Democrats would probably align towards Labour and the left rather than the Conservatives. In terms of Nick Clegg, I believe that the only real way for the Lib Dems to go forward and avoid an electoral nightmare in 2015 would be for him to walk away. But to see him walk away from the party that he's taken into Parliament, I think, is very unrealistic.
Johnny?
I think Nick Clegg's in a terrible position, personally. The party can't really afford to let him go because his job is toxic, as well as him being toxic. So whoever takes his job is going to then be branded with the same brush, because they're going to have to kind of let Tories get away with what they're getting away with. And it's good being less bad, but it's not really much of a leg to stand on at an election. So they probably want Clegg to stay until the election and then leave, as opposed to just walk away now, because that will put the party in a really bad position.
I'm not sure I agree with that totally. I feel like if we had another Liberal Democrat leader, maybe Vince Cable, and they didn't necessarily walk away from the coalition, which the Liberal Democrats couldn't at the moment. Their poll ratings are so low that the Liberal Democrats and Nick Clegg are the last people that want an early election. But even if they stayed in coalition with a new leader and possibly a tougher stance on what they're allowed to get through, then they could kind of gouge out a different reputation for themselves, maybe. I'd like to take up just one of the few characterisations of Liberal Democrats and Liberal Democrat voters as kind of all over the place and incohesive and Labour light, say. The Liberal Democrats are not quite that. I mean, they're for often disaffected Labour voters who didn't like the arrogant authoritarianism of Labour, and I think that's a genuine, decent position to stand on. I think it's a bit unfair to characterise them as such.
Okay, so I'm looking forward to the next election. It really is going to be make or break for the Liberal Democrats. I mean, keep in mind that at the last election, although they managed to get their way into government, they actually lost seats. And this becomes all the more crucial with the rise of UKIP, who are leading them in the polls, who could potentially displace them as the third party. And we could maybe see, in a worst-case scenario from the left's point of view, and a worst-case scenario from the Liberal Democrats and Labour's point of view, a minority Conservative government, either in coalition with or propped up by a UKIP element in Parliament. So what are the Lib Dems' options going into the next election? Is there any way that they can come out of the next election with something akin to a success, or is it only going to be damage limitation? Seb, I'll let you go first.
I'd firstly agree with your assessment that for the left, a UKIP Conservative coalition would be the absolute nightmare. But I think, look at kind of the polls, it's unlikely that UKIP will be able to get enough seats to make a significant difference in terms of their contribution. We talked about this the other week, but their contribution may be, you know, how they affect the Conservative Party votes. As for the Lib Dems, I think if we did replace Nick Clegg fairly soon before next election, maybe Cable or even Simon Hughes, who's deputy leader but isn't a member, isn't part of the government, may be less politically toxic in terms of that, I think we could be more successful in there. And I think what's also a point to make is that we tend to be more resilient than people give us credit for. However, I think the success mainly will be that we'll take a hit this election and hope that the transformation of being seen as a party of government will continue and eventually will be forgiven, particularly if, you know, there was a Lib Dem Labour coalition which would far better suit us and our members. So we'll have to wait and see.
I think we do the Liberal Democrats down too much. And it's not about, you know, the way the electoral system is. UKIP gets 18% of the vote and no seats, and Liberal Democrats get 11% and 50 seats. It's about, I think, their plan for 2015 is essentially we're going to hunker down and save as many seats as possible. Now, I think that's going to be more successful with Labour, where they're in sort of Labour areas, because the Labour Party aren't that infused to come out and vote, and I doubt they'll get any more infused when the economy starts picking up and their poll rating starts sliding. They're only on 3% today in the ICM poll, so that's interesting. But I think some Liberal Democrat seats in the so-called Conservative marginals will probably go, a bit more like Wells or Bath or something like that. But other areas like North Norfolk, where Norman Lamb is, that's just probably a bit too far. So I think we write off the Liberal Democrats too much. I expect them to be in a position similar to that of 2005, not totally annihilated. But their party may disappear over history.
I think one thing we have to consider is what Labour are doing at the next election. I think if they don't pull their finger out, it gives the Liberal Democrats a much better chance, because, you know, it's choosing between the worst winners, if you see what I mean. And at the minute, the Labour Party aren't doing anything to capitalise on how badly the Liberal Democrats are doing.
I'd slightly disagree with that, just in the sense that everybody has a go at the Labour Party, especially in this Parliament, for not setting out their stall early enough. But it's still a way away from a general election, and if you do set out your policy initiatives too early, you get criticised on it, and the opposition's policies start being subject to scrutiny rather than the government's themselves, and it's not how it's meant to work. It's not politically expedient to set out your policies this early.
Now, we've had a text in, thank you very much for whoever sent that in, saying the Lib Dems are a premonition of UKIP. Parties unprepared for power. Watch and learn, James. Would you like to respond to that, first of all?
I'd love to respond to that. I think that might be Luke, sat outside there, who sent that text in. But no, UKIP are a party ready for power. They've made the bridgeheads at the local election level. They're going to get people into councils. Although they're not meaningful on a national scale, they'll get there, they'll see that UKIP are a party that are ready to lead, they're ready to make a difference in local communities. And when it comes to the national election, the whole political spectrum has got to be wary of UKIP. They're taking voters off the Conservative right wing, the Labour left wing, and they're taking up the Liberal Democrats. So I would say that UKIP are a massive threat and they are ready for power.
Okay, well, that's the Farage line. To round things off, looking forward to 2015, how serious should we take the UKIP threat? Will the Lib Dems still be the third party by the time we come out of that election? Joe?
First past the post. No, the UKIP surge will be utterly underwhelming.
Elliot?
Once we get rid of the Muppet in number 10, I think the Conservative Party will probably soar quite a lot. But I do like what Daniel Hannan said a couple of days ago on Twitter, which is there should only be three parties at the election debates going on, which is Conservatives, Labour and UKIP.
And Seb, defend your party.
Firstly, that's completely ridiculous that you ignore the third biggest party in terms of seats just because Danny Hannan doesn't like them. UKIP in terms of seats won't get very many. They may get quite a large percentage of the vote. Lib Dems, even if we lose an awful lot, will comfortably stay the third biggest party in terms of seats.
Well, I promised the clause would come out eventually, and at long last they had. We've had one final text in here, which I'm going to read out just to finish off this debate, from Mr. Chris Brown, saying, how can UKIP be ready for government as a single issue party? If the Tories put the EU issue to bed now, will they have a case for power? Very interesting stuff. Thank you for that debate. Next up, we're going to take a look at David Cameron and his inner circle and ask if there's been some discrimination going on. But in the meantime, we're going to go to a bit of muddy waters. This is Baby, Please Don't Go.
I look down on him because I am upper class. I look up to him because he is upper class. But I look down on him because he is lower class. I am middle class. I know my place. I look up to them both. But I don't look up to him as much as I look up to him.
That was a bit of the Two Ronnies class sketch there. We're about to discuss David Cameron, the nature of his inner circle, and whether or not he is maybe an institutional racist or sexist or just generally discriminates. Reports emerged in The Telegraph this week that Sean Bailey, the Prime Minister's only black advisor, was forced out of number 10, having been really forced out by Cameron's old Etonian clique, which he apparently keeps around him. The report suggests that Cameron has gone so far as to inflame a class war within the Conservative Party between its upper class and middle class elements, primarily caused by his penchant for surrounding himself with public schoolboys, such as his Chief of Staff, Ed Llewellyn, Cabinet Office Minister Oliver Letwin, and most recently appointed his new advisor, Joe Johnson, the brother of Boris. Cameron himself has rejected these accusations of discrimination, however, citing the example of William Hague as a comprehensively schooled member of his key team. But the fact remains, there are no ethnic minorities and only one woman, Theresa May, on the Tory front bench. So, is David Cameron an institutional racist or an institutional sexist? Or institutionally prejudiced against people from less privileged backgrounds? The panel for this is joined by...
Hi, I'm David. I'm a PhD studying criminal justice, in particular the probation service.
And?
Luke, I'm a first-year law student.
And I can see you're all very, very keen to weigh in. So, David and Luke, since you're new on, I'll let you get in first.
Well, I'd first like to comment on the idea that the William Hague is some sort of token. That's fantastic to me. But... I don't think David Cameron is institutionally racist or sexist on the basis that an individual can't be institutionally racist or sexist. It seems to me that David Cameron probably isn't an out-and-out racist or an out-and-out sexist, or at least he doesn't think he is. But certainly there are issues with both race and sex in the composition of the cabinet and in the composition of the advisory staff and indeed much of Whitehall. It's not a phenomenon that's local to the Cameron administration. So I think there are questions that need to be answered here, and even though Mr. Bailey has gone out publicly on Twitter and said, look, I didn't say this in any degree of seriousness, I don't associate myself with those comments, I think Number 10 have treated me wonderfully, please will you give me an MP-ship in 5 years. Even though he said that, I think it does raise interesting questions that that deserve answers.
I think there's quite a stretch between someone like David Cameron putting himself in an environment within which he's comfortable and being, as was suggested, racist or sexist or anything-ist. Because I think in, and this is perhaps a naive view, but I think in a modern society with a prime minister, somebody who's brought in the policy, you know, it's not like he's a raving right wing or raving any wing sort of, you know, he's a moderate individual who's in Number 10. I think people can at least agree that. And I think to suggest that somehow he's racist and therefore forcing out Sean Bailey, there's no logical sort of, that's not a logical conclusion to reach. What I would suggest is that possibly David Cameron is in an environment within which he's comfortable, and that as a result of those people that are in there, it could be something that does seem quite an exclusive. I mean, it asks questions rather of David Cameron, I think, than people who work in politics and in the sort of culture that there is in an office working for a politician, rather than David Cameron himself.
I think the report in the Telegraph that you mentioned seemed to state that primarily, rather than it being an issue of race, was more of a class issue, not necessarily because David Cameron dislikes or doesn't want people working class working for, but more the fact that Bailey constantly brought up kind of more working class aspects, saying how does this look to working class, and constantly spoke up about that, and obviously a perspective that none of his other advisers were giving, and therefore they were upset that he was giving that kind of perspective. I should say that the idea that, you know, we're not against classist, you know, we've got William Hague in the cabinet is a pretty bit like saying I'm not racist, I've got a black friend. I don't think that works against it. I think, though, I should say, to be fair, Cam, when you think about kind of compositions of women and I think minorities, you've got to think, yeah, although he probably shouldn't be doing better, you've got to remember it is the Conservative Party, so he's got less scope for, although actually the Lib Dems are quite bad on this minority-wise MPs, but certainly in terms of class-wise, the Conservative Party are predominantly middle and upper class, so he has got less scope to work with on that.
Right, I'd like to say two things. Firstly, I think the sort of saying that there's only white Etonians in Number 10 and David Cameron being racist is sort of a casual link, actually. It's because he's actually a really bad leader. Essentially, what he does is David Cameron can't manage people. You can see that with the Europe issue, where he's just like all over the place constantly. And so what is sort of happening is he surrounds himself with people who are friendly and are like-minded to him and people who he actually agrees with. So essentially surrounded himself with yes men. They just happen to be these people because they sort of agree with him for other reasons. You know, he's not being, you know, giving people handshakes and, you know, they're not all members of the Masons or something. But, you know, also on the Liberal Democrats, and luckily you saved yourself from an absolute smashing there, Seb, because, you know, Liberal Democrats, out of all, they have the worst percentage-wise of women MPs, and they have no ethnic minorities at all. I think even in the composition of Liberal Democrats HQ, it's even worse. I think they have, like, two ethnic minorities on the, you know, massively wide 200-member staff running Liberal Democrat Central Office, which is just awful. And I would like to say, with the Conservative Party, that these people are here. they are, and they're coming in even more now. It's just because things take a long time, because essentially these are 45-year-olds coming in.
Okay. Now, rightly or wrongly, the Conservative Party still do have an image problem, and it's nowhere near what it was, but it is still there. And initiatives like the A-list system, in practice, don't seem to have done much, and Luke is shaking his head as I even mention it. So my question for you next is, if there is a solution out there, what would it be? Are there any easy solutions? Probably not, but if you've got any ideas, James, I'm open to them.
In terms of the A-list, I think what you need to do is you need to... It comes down to a grassroots level. You've got to promote your ethnic minorities and women and get them into politics and get them out at local level. I think that's the main way that you can push through a new generation of people who almost feel disenfranchised with politics or just the Conservative Party as a general. It can push them in at a low local level, and that will build up and fill. And I mean, I hate this idea of statistics as a, I don't know, 20% women, 20% ethnic minority. It's about who's best at their job, and I think that's the right way to go down.
I think there is there's an element of truth in that, and certainly you do need to start building up across all parties and indeed beyond that party. I mean, listen to us white men going on about how bad it is for women and black people in politics. But the point is that we've been doing that really since the 1990s, since Stephen Lawrence made institutional racism a massive political thing. And no party could be said to have not really... been trying to reach out to minority communities, whether in terms of gender, race, age, whatever, because it's a good way to win votes. It's a good way to be seen to be doing something. But it doesn't work by itself. And I think part of the reason it doesn't work by itself is the symbology of it, the framing of it, the framing of Westminster and Whitehall as still predominantly white male upper middle class pursuits. So I think the best thing that David Cameron could do is to live up to the commitment that he made in 2010 to have one in three women in his cabinet, which, you know, is great because obviously then they'll be equally represented with both of the other genders, and get some black and minority and ethnic people in there, because I think there are people out there who can do the job as well as the likes of, I don't know, pluck a name at random out of the hat, Michael Gove, Andrew Lansley, Theresa May, even people as respected as that in the Conservative Party, there are people out there who could do that job just as well. And I don't see why a little bit of affirmative action now can't make that meritocratic system work better in the future, because people will be more invested in the system as a whole.
Luke?
I think it is a question of accessibility over forcing people into particular positions. And I think what David said is true. There's probably a perception amongst people who aren't already part of sort of the Westminster classes that they don't want to be involved in politics necessarily, and that's why there is an overrepresentation of people who have always traditionally been in that position. And it's about breaking out of that. But I would always suggest that an affirmative action sort of policy isn't the right way, because it is patronising. It's not a sustainable investment for the future that's going to get people interested down the line. What it's about is it's about appealing to these people, and it's about making it clear to everyone that, you know, Westminster's not out of bounds, whether you want to work there, whether you want to be an MP. I mean, one of the things I was going to mention about, and I did mention about Sean Bailey, is that I think it's to do with possibly Cameron's staff and his office and the atmosphere in that, rather than David Cameron himself. And that is undoubtedly motivated by the fact that the people who aspire to Westminster careers, who want to work with the Prime Minister, are people who come from the sort of backgrounds we've suggested. So it's about making that accessible and more appealing to other people, and that's going to change the culture, rather than just trying to force people into set statistics and figures.
You know, there hasn't been a major Westminster shift in how we change our way to do it, to approach for women or ethnic minorities, and yet they're still coming through. I think it is a lot more than people think a time issue that these people are going to come. You know, you see it every single year, and with the candidate shortlist we have, where we haven't used the A-list, which is a great move by David Cameron, across there are more women than before, there's more black people than before, and we're not doing it on a, you know, we're doing it on a highly, a totally meritocratic basis. There's no point point, you know, wavering in and saying we have to have all these sort of quotas. And, you know, on sort of the thing of Tories being elitist, that is so slow, that is wearing off and it is running so thin now with the Labour Party. You know, the more people went to state schools in the Conservative Party than did in Labour, and that's proportionally, not just because we have more numbers. They are more elitist than we are, and I think that's coming through.
I think while it is useful, and we do need to look at, say, the percentage of the cabinets, women and minorities, and Parliament, we also have to look at it going back earlier in the chain, because clearly, while we can say, well, are there any minorities and women, you know, in Parliament that could be put in the cabinet who do the job just as well, what we really need to look at is, well, are there any people who are as qualified as the cabinet, or who were qualified as qualified as the cabinet at one point, that didn't get involved in politics or in the party, or got involved and then didn't go as far as the current cabinet members, and that are there any way to is there any factors that are making, you know, white middle upper class men more likely to enter politics and Parliament and the cabinet that are stopping just or more able minorities from getting into it? And that solution really has to be addressed. That problem has to be addressed. And while that will take time, I think that's the only way all three parties can kind of get to grips with that.
Okay, I've got 3 points, which I'll try and keep very, very short, because I can see Gaffer's freaking out. First of all, I think Luke is right that we do need to be careful about the sort of affirmative action we engage in, because, I mean, when you do affirmative action wrong, you just end up with people like Blair's babes, Brown's babes, whatever that was, which obviously is the least sexist thing they could have been called. But essentially where they're there just for window dressing, where they are essentially tokenistic, and it's important I stress that William Hague isn't a tokenistic investment. The idea that William Hague is not a member of the cultural elite is laughable. Which brings me on to my second point, sort of coming back to what Elliot was saying about the Labour Party. Yes, it's true, a lot of everybody in every party goes to state schools, and that's a problem. But class is about more than just the educational system you were built up in. And I think one of the reasons the Conservatives still have this issue with image is because they still attach quite a lot to that education on the one level, and also in the way that they behave and in the policies that they pursue, the ideology they pursue, they're perceived as being more elitist. Third point, very quickly, I think this is a wider problem than the political system as well, which the Blair's Babes phenomenon points to. I mean, the media, again, we're a bunch of white men sitting around a table, and I'm not saying any of us have decided that we hate women or that we hate black people. Maybe some of us have, I don't know. I like to think I haven't. But the point is, the point is that institutions like the media, institutions like universities, all need to be examined critically, because it's this sort of institutional racism and sexism that endures. Arguably, the BBC has made strides in this department, for instance, in introducing more female news anchors and things like that. But then again, looking at all of the controversies that have been enveloping the BBC recently, it looks like the BBC didn't have to go far from rock bottom to be a non-sexist institution. It still had those issues. So that's my point. Wider than the political system.
Very eloquently put. Just got one last question to throw out to all of you. And that is that we seem to have honed in here on the need for change from the bottom up, grassroots change. But as everyone who takes a look at politics knows, the grassroots is the hardest part of a political party or a political movement to change. It has the most entrenched views. It has the most extreme views, more often than not. And we've even seen that here in our very own community, because the Nottingham University Conservative Association have, on occasion, gone up to a few things that could maybe be interpreted as somewhat discriminatory or at least somewhat closed-minded. Who leads the way to get a sea change in the grassroots? Is that possible? How do you make that come about quickly, if at all? Elliot, you want to defend your people.
Who leads the way? It's the Nottingham University Conservative Association, from essentially people who want to be, you know, sort of enforce views on people, which is totally wrong. And you've seen it here. The same people who were saying that we shouldn't debate, you know, something about rape, which we turned down in the end. We said that we were completely against the motion. They said we shouldn't do that. The same people who want to force, you know, their beliefs on abortion onto people. Essentially, these are people who are we're essentially going backwards to a sort of liberal sort of authoritarianism, which is completely against any sort of liberal principle. And so, conservatives are the way forward.
James?
Yeah, I think we have a real problem that it is where the grassroots needs to come through, but the problem is that everyone within that is naive. I mean, the Nuka scandal is just outrageous. And I've been there myself and I've experienced it, and it is just a really intimidating atmosphere. And I could not imagine in my appearances there that people could come in from ethnic backgrounds, from female backgrounds. Although they won't be ostracised, they won't fit in. And that's the real problem at this grassroots level.
David, one last little bit.
I think the grassroots needs leadership from the top. It can't all be bottom up. It has to be assisted by the right environment and the right symbology from the top. There has to be the right framing, which is the point I made about the rape debate. Don't not have that debate, but frame it in a respectful and careful manner.
Okay, well, we really have run out of time on that debate. I'm sorry, Johnny. I'm sorry. We go to a song now. Changes by David Bowie, after which we're going to have a talk about the future of the probation system.
I am the law! I never broke the law! I am the law! You betray the law!
Mr. I am the law!
A clip there from Judge Dredd, which...
Can I just say that's exactly what probation is like?
It's rumoured that if Michael Gove were to get the Justice Minister's job, he'd model British policing on that. So make of that what you will. We're going to wade into the debate on the future of the British probation system this week. Justice Secretary Chris Grayling announced plans which could change the face of the probation of defenders upon their release from prison, change the face of how we do that forever. Under the proposals, probation services will be opened up to the private sector, with private companies and charities offered payment by results for supervising people released from prison. Furthermore, in a change to the current system where anyone who has served a sentence in prison of 12 months or less does not undergo probation, absolutely anyone released from any sentence will be supervised for 1 year and immediately returned to prison if they reoffend in that time. Grayling has argued that these reforms, with the rate of reoffending rising steadily, will inject a much needed dose of efficiency into the probation system. However, representatives of the Howard League for Penal Reform have argued that these statistics in fact show that short prison sentences just don't work, and that much greater emphasis should be put on community sentences and rehabilitation, not on punishment. So, with another section of the public service seemingly on the verge of privatisation, is this reform really being brought through to improve results? Or is it just part of the ongoing free market crusade that we've been experiencing ever since the Thatcher years? David, I know this is a subject close to your heart, so I will let you begin.
Yeah, a rant incoming, so you know you might want to tune out for a couple of minutes. But the first point to make is that the probation service don't just deal with people who've been released from prison. They're not just responsible for parole. They're also responsible for community sentences. They're responsible for compiling pre-service reports. In fact, one academic recently described them as the most powerful actors within the criminal justice process, because they have all of these different roles to fill. Anyway, point is, to answer the actual question, I think it's about both. On the one hand, but it's not necessarily about Thatcherism either, because I don't think Thatcher would be at all comfortable with rationing off the criminal justice system. Even she would never go that far. Because even she would have thought of it as an essential function of the state. But in enough hypothesis about Thatcherism, I think it's more about economic recovery than anything else, trying to create new jobs, create new markets for private sector industry to get involved in. But I think it's a terrible idea, and we'll come back to that, I'm sure.
I mean, there's a few problems I see with this, at least, that I'm sure David will pick up and elaborate on and probably run with, and I hope he does. One being payment by results. You pay someone by results, you assume that A, they're only motivated by money, and B, that results can be measured. Not everything you do with a prisoner can be empirically measured. You can't, when a prisoner comes out of prison and they're trying to get back into society, you can't measure empirically all of the ways in which they get back into society. Such a success is not measurable in that way, and thus payment by results simply won't work. Second of all, if you pay by results, they will take only the cases in which they think they can get results, leaving a vast swath of people coming out of prison that are seen as hopeless cases and just left to crash and burn and reoffend, as we say. That is my first problem with it. My second will be that 70% of the probation service is going to be privatised, and the 70% of the employees, I assume, are going to lose their jobs as well. Yes, they can regain them in the private sector with atrocious pensions, half the wage. My dad is a probation officer at the moment. In a year and a half, he probably won't be, and I don't really know how he's going to afford to live. Not to bring the personal sub-story into it, but this does affect real people, and it may well make efficiency savings, but it depends where you're making those savings. If people's livelihoods are going down the drain, then I don't think it's necessarily a great thing.
Luke, could you like to come in?
I think the one of the key things about these proposals, and I know that David is obviously far more knowledgeable than me on this, so I'll leave sort of the technical side of it to him. But the idea is that at the moment, people who have not been, or rather people who have been in prison for 12 months or less, do not get the support at the moment that they should be getting. And we're talking about prison not working. Maybe it's not the process of prison that's not working, but the fact that they're not getting the support afterwards, and the fact that they are going from a position where they are in prison to being just straight out of prison, thrown on the street. And if prison's not doing its rehabilitative job inside, then it should be doing it outside, and it should be carrying it on from what's going on inside it. I mean, I don't get the issue that people have with the idea of the private, and particularly the voluntary sector, being involved with this. We're talking about the private sector being motivated only by money, and we're talking about them taking the making of money and saving money over delivering good service. Well, look at the government at the moment, and look at what government will need to do if they're going to take down the money that we owe. If they're going to get this debt down, if they're going to close the deficit, they are going to need to be motivated by the fact that actually they can't afford to do everything they want to do. And that means that effectively the private sector and the public sector now, there's little to choose between them.
Johnny?
I think one of the things that you have to take into consideration with this debate is the record of private companies taking over public sector. G4S, for example. Thank you, Joe. But also, I mean, the trains have now become more expensive, and they're the most expensive in Europe. Are the private sector going to charge the government more than the public sector cost? There's the big six at the minute with the energy that are pushing up prices, and there's not much we can do about it. I think that giving this kind of thing over to the private sector is going to be a disaster in the best circumstances.
Yeah, I broadly follow on from that. I think it's already happened in criminal justice. Electronic monitoring, tagging of offenders, both for the purposes of people released from prison and as a community sentence in its own right, accompanying a curfew. That's a situation which is already fully done by the private sector, and it's run in duopoly conditions because there are only two companies, G4S and Serco, that are big enough to operate at a massive level. It's worth noting because the traditional idea, one of the reasons why this is being pushed through is because there's this idea that the private sector encourages innovation because they're closer to the sort of the grassroots, and that means that more of these ideas can pull through. Absolute rot, because these providers who are going to go for these contract areas will be bigger than the state. They have a greater income than the state because companies like G4S and Serco are massive international companies with no investiture in the values or the processes of doing good probation. They see an opportunity to make that money, and they spontaneously grow a new justice service effectively overnight. So the idea then is that they'll then subcontract out to voluntaries. But the first thing is, the only voluntaries that can really engage in criminal justice processes are likely to be massive and national anyway. And the second point is that all of these people who are being subcontracted out, the smaller groups, which is presumably where the probation staff are going to end up in institutions called mutuals, which they're not being allowed to prepare for now, so it's unclear whether or not that will come to pass. Point is, we're looking at a system where the profit imperative is being put at the very heart of criminal justice, with a very hazy idea of reducing reoffending, governing payment by results. It's ridiculous, it's ideological, and it's a profoundly dangerous thing. People are going to be victims of crime because of these reforms.
Joe?
Another point that I'd like to make as well, well, two, but I'll make one, is the fact that these reforms have been handled incredibly badly in their implementation. My dad, again, received an email saying that if any probation officer speaks out against the government reforms, they're going to be on well, probation, as it were. They're going to be having a disciplinary. They are not allowed to have a political voice. Mm. Probation officers are not allowed to speak out against these reforms because they are losing their jobs, and these reforms are wrong. That, I can show you the email if you disagree with me. Like, that actually happened. It came from the top. Second of all, apparently rehabilitation is being... is a focus, is a good thing according to Luke, yet we are cutting the rehabilitatory service, which is the probation service. The problem here is like the problem with drugs. You can't cut prisons because it's not politically expedient. It looks like you're not tough on crime, despite the fact, as the Nordic countries have shown time and time and time again, prison, especially short-term prison sentences, doesn't actually work. You need to focus on rehabilitation rather than punishment.
And we've had a text in from Louis from Lenton saying just that. Elliot, I'm going to let you slip a very brief point in before you explode.
Yeah, essentially, I want to actually sort of defend what's going on here because, you know, they're talking about... I think there's something that's been mentioned by David and by... as well. It's actually good. It's competitiveness which is key. It's not necessarily privatisation. You can privatise to one company and get less competitiveness. Now, if there's two companies, it's a lot better. But what they should do is put it out loads and loads and loads more, which I don't think they have been doing. I think that some implementation is generally can be very bad, and especially where you're saying they're sending off letters saying don't have a political voice, which is just nonsense. It's essentially government itself, which at best, which is just bad. But at least they're taking the initiative and saying this is actually something good to go across. And I'm a bit more optimistic because I've had a look at these reports, and they don't seem to be on the similar stance of, you know, the railways, where they said we're going to nationalise whole lines to one company where there's no competition, which is not privatisation at all. It's is worse at the state.
Johnny?
I just want to say, I think that introducing competition into the prison market is just... I'm not sure I have the words in my vocabulary to
it's
to,
gross.
Yeah, it's okay, gross. Yeah. But we've seen today it come out that the big oil is colluding to raise prices. If they do that with prisons and the price gets too expensive for the state, they'll be too big to fail and it will cost billions.
The fundamental aim of privatisation is to get you more for less money. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, we've already discussed that we seem to think that things like rehabilitation are the most effective means. By definition, they are expensive. Does that mean that if you're going to get results with probation, it will be, by definition, expensive, irrespective of whether it's private sector, public sector mix? David?
First thing to say is, again, this isn't going to cut costs. If you look at electronic monitoring, our costs are 13 times higher because we're in duopoly conditions than in the US, where it's also privatised, but it's to a much more diffuse market. So Elliot is right to a certain extent. Privatisation isn't the enemy, but it's being done in such a cack-handed way because they've designed it with these great big massive service areas, arbitrarily dividing up the country into massive regions. And the only people who can go for that are going to be the giant multinationals. So the idea that it's going to drive down costs is laughable, quite frankly. But the second point, to actually answer your question, I don't think it's about costs. I think one of the great things about the probation service has been that it's retained a very clear set of values and a very good idea of what it's doing, what the best processes are for that. You look at community sentences, they have a much lower recidivism rate than imprisonment for exactly that reason. And we are cutting these people adrift. Masses of them are going to retire and move into other fields in 2014 when these plans come into effect. And we are going to lose one of the very best institutions of criminal justice, of punishment, of rehabilitation that we've seen. And it will be the end of a very great 100-year tradition.
We are out of time. Johnny, I want you to round us off.
I just want to say, at the end of that, I think that there is some things that you can't measure in monetary values. And I think that the state is much better at dealing with those things than the private sector, which has to deal with things in a monetary value. And I don't think that pushing for... reforms to change it to a privatised system is a good idea.
We've been The Big Picture. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much if you texted in. I'm sorry we couldn't read them all out. We'll be back at the same time next week. Right now it's time for I Want to Break Free by Queen, and we'll be handing you over to Dance Delirium.